All statements and opinions expressed by guests of the Adult in the Room podcast are strictly their own and do not necessarily reflect the beliefs or opinions of the host, producers, or advertisers. All interviews are presented in their most complete possible form in the interests of free speech. No statements should be interpreted as financial, legal, or medical advice. Listener and viewer discretion are strongly advised.
It's the Adult in the Room podcast with Victoria Taft. That's me. It's a special edition of the Adult in the Room podcast with Victoria Taft. How you doing? Americans, as you know, because you're living through these times, they're disgusted with our formerly trusted institutions. And they have wished that they could be, well, sometimes done away with, redone, or imploded. Take your pick. We've thought about this at the Department of Justice, the FBI, big journalism, the CIA, as Americans have watched these institutions rot before our eyes. They've degraded themselves, and they've degraded themselves into being political tools of the Democrats in this case. And it should be said that none of the institutions that I've just mentioned are in the Constitution. These are things upon which we rely so heavily, but they're not actually in our founding documents. We have seen fit to include them later because we had a need and they had a mission. And now they're not fulfilling their mission. So what do? Right now they're being owned like the Kremlin owned the KGB and the SVR. They're just a political appendage of one political group. And indeed, during the shameful 2016 election, kind of the Russia collusion hoax, 2015 through 20, well, up until 2020, we had the Russian collusion hoax against Donald Trump, and the CIA was in the thick of it. You hated the FBI for what it did, even though you civil libertarians out there, you knew it was wrong. And not a lot of you said anything. You liberals who are the classical liberals out there. Not a lot of you said anything. And you should be ashamed for it because it will continue. And now everybody, of course, is worried that if Donald Trump gets back into office in 2024, he'll turn the institutions on them. Well, probably not, but he didn't do it before, but he was too busy fighting. So there've been so many more places that the spy agencies interceded on behalf of a political party that it's dumbfounding. It really is. And that's why I was so interested in talking with Charles Sam Faddis. Faddis was in charge of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. His expertise was on weapons of mass destruction. He served as the chief station in the Middle East. And now he's out and talking about how to write this spy agency. He has written several books, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and Willful Neglect, The Dangers Illusion, the Dangerous Illusion of Homeland Security. I think I might have muffed that title. Let me just make sure. Yeah, The Dangerous Illusion of Homeland Security. Thanks, autocorrect. Recently, he was a guest at Hillsdale College, where it's Primus organ, the school organ it sends out to people like me, excerpted his speech called Why the CIA No Longer Works and How We Can Fix It. And I thought, well, if anybody can fix it, he can tell us how. Sam Faddis, welcome to the Adult in the Room podcast. How are you?
I am doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
I wore my Mitch Rapp t-shirt today because I happen to be a Vince Flynn fan, but also because you might be the closest thing to a Vince Rapp Mitch Rapp person that I'll ever come across. You're a bona fide spook. You went out and killed people and broke things and you fixed things. And now you think you can fix the CIA, and how?
Well, I mean, look, as a baseline, I would say this. If, you know, the first thing you need to do at CIA is send somebody there who knows how it works. Because otherwise they will lead you around by the nose forever and you will be lost in the maze of mirrors. And then what you really need is a president with the will to stand behind that person and say, I will back you. You have my full support. Break as much China as you need. Fire as many people as you need. And it's a matter of take. I mean, it's a I define the problem of breakdown, the way I put it in the speech that you referenced, was bureaucratization and politicization. Part of the problem that's been going on for a long time is the place has gone soft. It has become a bureaucracy as opposed to the sharp tool that you need. And the second that you also referenced is the political aspect, right? CIA should not be within 10 miles of American domestic politics. It's not its charter. It is patently illegal. It's that clear cut. You shouldn't be anywhere near it, but you need to drive those things home. So you're going to be a lot of work. You're going to have to roll up your sleeves, do it the old fashioned way. Is it doable? It's doable. Yeah.
Who was the last CIA director who thought like that? Go out and be a spy agency.
I don't know. Casey, probably 30 years ago now. I mean, you know, that just the process of going soft in the sense of becoming just another federal bureaucracy and cumbersome and layers of management, that's been going on forever. And I mean, let me be clear. The agency should be as responsive to national government as the Marine Corps is, as the U.S. Army is. Nobody, when I say going soft, I'm not, there's no subtext that it should be allowed to go rogue, go do whatever it wants to do. It works for the President of the United States. It should follow orders and color inside the lines in that sense. But when you send them to hunt down Al-Qaeda, you kind of don't want some guys who specialize in PowerPoint presentations back home. You kind of want some boys and girls who can handle themselves on the street. And then, as I say, then there's the other dimension of everything you talked about, which is its interference in and involvement in domestic politics. The answer to that all should be, to anybody who asks, we don't do that. We don't break U.S. law. We don't violate the U.S. Constitution. I don't care what you threaten me with. I don't fire me. Whatever. I'm not doing it.
Yeah. When did anybody get fired for doing anything wrong? When was the last time some high profile guy got fired? Oh, wait, I'm sorry. J. Edgar Comey over at FBI. That's it.
I was having this conversation with an old boss of mine. Actually, I probably had it several times with him over the last year or so. And we were both saying, look, you know, if you were sitting in the field now and you were still active and somebody sent you a message telling you to do X, Y, and Z, and it's clearly in violation of U.S. law, and what would your response be? And his answer was, well, I guess maybe I might start by saying, are you really telling me what I think you're telling me? Because it sounded like you said this. And then if it was in fact that direction, the answer would be, well, that's not happening, guys. I don't know what drugs you're taking back in Washington, D.C., but I'm not your secret police. I'm not doing that.
But they are.
Well, I mean, some of them clearly have stepped across lines that are crystal clear. There are no gray area here on some of the things that happen. You got 51 guys, not all of them were CIA, but at least five of them were either former directors or acting directors. In other words, they used to be the boss at CIA, at least five of them that I can think of off the top of my head, that signed on to the infamous letter saying Hunter Biden's laptop is Russian disinformation, saying in effect it's a fake, it's a forgery, pay no attention, nothing to see. Okay, I was one of the first people to see Hunter Biden's laptop early on because I was asked to look at it because the people who had it were concerned it might be a fake. And they did not want to run with a story if they were being played. And so they brought me in. No bias. Tell me what you think. If it's a fake, tell me. Crystal clear from 5 minutes into it. It's impossible to fake this. You couldn't fake it. It's operationally impossible to have created such a thing and have it stand up to scrutiny. And yet you got five guys who used to run the CIA who signed on to a letter saying, in effect, it's a fake, it's a forgery. Now, they either didn't care or they knew they were lying. But either way, there's no excuse for that, right? That's a clear, deliberate interference in American domestic politics. And they knew it when they signed the letter.
They used weasel words so that they could come back later and say, well, we used the weasel words here, so we didn't actually say what you think we thought we said. But, you know, of course they meant that. Of course they intended for that. I read Mike Morrell's book when he left as acting CIA head chief. And he used to give the presidential daily briefing. He writes about that. He writes about, you know, being flung hither and yon, but he doesn't talk about being in the field anywhere that I can recall.
To my knowledge, Morrell was never in the field. Morrell was a guy who sat behind a desk at headquarters as a functionally an admin guy, who the next thing you know is the head of the agency. But look, I mean, there's another example of interference, right? Benghazi is from Jump Street, a full-on assault on a State Department compound, the CIA compound. There's an army of terrorists with mortars, heavy machine guns, rifles. It's a war. Every piece of reporting from the field, from the CIA, State Department, Department of Defense, says that. And I know the guys that were on the ground. So Washington heard one message. We're under attack. We're in the middle of a war. Send help. The next thing you know, Susan Rice is running around saying this was a peaceful demonstration that got out of hand. And when it blew up and they got called on it, the Obama administration, who shows up? Mike Morrell shows up and he says, my bad. My analysts produced faulty analysis. And that's what the White House relied upon. It's not their fault. It's mine. That's a lie. CIA analysts sitting in Langley did not read a mountain of traffic about mortar attacks, rocket attacks, and write a piece of analysis that said, we think this was a peaceful demonstration. And nobody ever produced that analysis. Why did he do it? He took a bullet for Hillary. He took a bullet for Obama because I'm sure Hillary said, you will be the director or you'll be the national security advisor. Too bad for him. She lost and he didn't get his job. But then they parked him in a six-figure-a-year job at a Democratic think tank in Washington, D.C. as a consolation prize. No, I didn't even remember the name, but it's one you've never heard, but it doesn't matter. I'm sure that I would suspect Morrell never shows up to the office. He just pockets $600,000 a year or whatever because he covered them.
You know, that all 51 intelligence officials, these experts, also were done. They were asked to sign this at the behest of Tony Blinken, who's now the Secretary of State. And the same players from the Obama administration have, and Hillary's close friends now were with the Biden administration. And I have to ask, is there anything that Biden's done right? Or does Robert Gates, he hasn't made any good foreign policy decisions in the last 40 years, string of bad decisions continue to this day?
If you can find a decision that Joe Biden has made that was to the benefit of the United States of America since he sat down the Oval Office, you're doing better than I am. I think if you did one of those old school decision trees, like where yes, no kind of thing, at every decision, honestly, not only is it to the detriment of the United States of America, but probably to the benefit of Beijing. At every single juncture since the man entered the Oval Office.
Does this have to do with the decisions made about Iran and paying off Iran for some inexplicable reason? And for example, getting out of Afghanistan? I mean, these things made no sense to me. The way in which we got out of Afghanistan was just shameful, and it just tanked the morale of the people who'd spent years there. It was an atrocity, and I could say more, But I think you understand what I mean. I mean, what was that about? What is the rapprochement with Iran about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you put your finger on something really important here, which is we've never had an administration that was this catastrophic. This is not just, I mean, a lot of the press does its best to prevent the American people from fully understanding what's happening. But what's happening is threatening directly to the national security of the United States. It's on such a scale that we're in danger as a country. So you're kind of left with two choices, aren't you? You can either say, this is the most staggeringly incompetent administration in American history, and they just somehow happen to get it wrong every single time. When you would think the law of averages would say every once in a while they'd do something right. Or you can begin to contemplate something that's almost unthinkable, would have been one day, once upon a time, which is that you're talking about people who aren't really acting in our interest. That talk about Iran. I mean, there are a lot of people at senior positions in this administration who I think actually think we're the bad guys in the confrontation with Iran. And look, I've worked with a lot of Iranians over the years. I've got nothing but respect for Iranians, Persian culture, history, the greatness of that country. The Ayatollahs that are in charge are psychopaths, and they are brutalizing their own people, and they're a threat to world peace and a danger to us all. And the idea that you think those are the guys who are on the right side of history is really terrifying. So, but when you do that, yeah, you give them billions of dollars. We created a terrorist super state in Afghanistan. All the usual suspects are back in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda. They once again have a platform from which to operate. They have $84 billion worth of our hardware. The United Nations sends every 2 weeks $80 million to the Taliban.
Every 2 weeks?
Every 2 weeks, $80 million that the UN sends. We pay the lion's share of that. So even as the Taliban is giving safe haven to Al-Qaeda and supporting the Pakistani Taliban and trying to overthrow the Pakistani government, we're pumping money. We've pumped in something like $6 billion since we left. And the way they color this is they say it's going for humanitarian purposes. Now, what staggers me is that you can say that with a straight face. That's the part that's stunning to me. Because you're like, you're handing this money to Islam, to terrorists. I mean, you're handing this money to the Haqqanis, who actually are still on our most wanted list with prices on their head. But
we never got rid of the Haqqani family. We never got rid of that group.
And you trust the word of Siraj Haqqani as to how he's going to, you think he's using that money for baby formula? Is that what I just heard you tell me? I mean, come on, man. It's breathtaking that you have the chutzpah to tell me that lie. That's what's breathtaking.
You also say that the Wuhan virus, I mean, this all plays, all of these issues that we've been talking about, these colossal failures on the part of the Biden administration are, you also look through the lens of the CIA and what a spook worth his or her salt would do about that. And the Wuhan virus, you know, nobody's home. 9/11, no one was home. So talk a little bit about some of the massive failures that could have been reconciled and rectified, rather, that had we been a more muscular organization that paid more attention to tradecraft and spies than in political machinations in the United States.
Yeah, well, this is the thing is, I hear from people sometimes now that, you know, this idea that we should abolish the CIA. I get where they're coming from. All right. You know, you can't have a domestic, you can't have a foreign intelligence collection apparatus, which is what CIA is, that decides it gets to decide who gets to be president of the United States.
It's frightening.
That ought to be a pretty hard and fast rule. But the fact of the matter is we need a collection. I mean, the world gets more dangerous all the time. And as technology increases, weapons of mass destruction and so forth, the margin for error decreases, right? I mean,
but you run out of chances.
Yeah, you need that warning, right? I mean, you can stand up. I don't want to write a primer for anybody, but as a guy who did a lot of weapons of mass destruction work, I mean, you can set up a bio lab to produce stuff that you need to kill a lot of people and operate out of an apartment with stuff that you can order off the internet. And what you really need is some competent lab techs. In other words, it's not super secret science. There's only one guy in the world with a big brain who knows how to do this. So you really need a very, very hard, competent organization. Again, hard in the sense of professional, disciplined, capable of taking the fight to the enemy. And because if you don't, well, I mean, look, you brought up Wuhan. Okay, so Wuhan is the site of a BSL-4 lab. It's the only BSL-4 lab in China. That means biological safety level 4. That's the top level. So what that means in shorthand is that's the place with all the safeguards to play with the most dangerous organisms. There's one of them in China. It's in Wuhan. The Chinese have never really walked away from biological warfare. Biological warfare is a tier zero collection requirement for CIA. What's that mean? It means there's nothing more important than collecting on bio warfare, because you could literally kill a large portion of the people in the United States with biological agents if you could crack the code on exactly how to do it. So you add all this stuff up. The Chinese are our number one enemies. Bio warfare is top tier priority. Wuhan's their number one lab. You shouldn't have been able to hear a pin drop in the Wuhan lab in 2019 without CIA telling you about it. We should have had that place wired six ways from Sunday, from computers to technical ops to like 10 guys in the lab on our payroll. Right? Because there's nothing more important. We received no warning of COVID-19. It's been 4 years. If you ask the intelligence community, they still don't have a firm assessment of how this thing got started. So what's that tell you? It tells you we didn't have any sources in Wuhan in 2019. And it tells you that apparently we still don't have any sources inside Wuhan 4 years later. Now, why does the Central Intelligence Agency exist, right? It's not to provide generic think tank analysis. It's to go steal the crown jewels, right? That's your friggin' job, man. Recruit some Chinese scientists inside that lab. By the way, they send about 50,000 scientists here every year who are all over the United States. So you don't have to crawl around trying to recruit them in Wuhan. You could recruit them here before they go home, you know, where they're all completely accessible to you and not being supervised by the Chinese. Anyway, the bottom line is it's your job. And it's really important that we know. And we could go on down a long list of targets, right? That's what CIA is supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Do you think that the CIA is held in thrall of the political aspect of Joe Biden's being in the pocket of the Chinese? I'm trying to think of a better way to say it than that, but he's getting paid by him, so, or has been through his son's machinations. Do you think that they go easy on China because of Joe?
Well, look, first of all, I think we ought to just say out loud what is obvious in regard to Joe. The best estimate I've seen is that the Bidens took something like $31 million, and I'm not sure that that's not a lowball figure, from not just the Chinese, right? And let's be clear, this is not about the Chinese people. They took that from Chinese intelligence, from guys directly, Chinese spies, folks that are part of their apparatus. And what do? Their job is to engage in what they call elite capture. That's their term. They buy important people in target countries and make them do what they want them to do. by the way, is what that's the bread and butter of what spies do. They gain control over you. They pay you. They don't ask you to do them favors. They gain control over you, and then you do what you are told. In fact, if you don't have that kind of control over an asset, it's not an asset. So known Chinese intel figures, including one, Patrick Ho, that we sent to prison in the United States for doing this to African leaders. At the same time he was doing it to the Bidens, they arrested him, convicted him, and sent him to prison for what he was doing with the Africans, and then just pretended like they didn't see his contacts. But in any event, that's so you're talking about Joe and these guys and the Chinese, that's what you're talking about. It's not just corruption. They took money they shouldn't have taken. Maybe they did a favor. No, this is established fact that the Chinese do this with a specific purpose. Now, that guy is sitting in the Oval Office that took tens of millions of dollars from Chinese intelligence. What the heck? I mean, come on. What do you think they gave him the money for? I mean, what? They're not fools. There are a lot of things. They are not stupid. They got something in return. What do you think they're getting for $31 million? And are we really supposed to look now at American policy vis-a-vis the Chinese and pretend like we don't know any of that? My hesitation when you asked the question initially is based on the fact that, unfortunately, most of the members of his cabinet who are national security figures, also, if you look into their backgrounds, have been up to their eyeballs in Chinese money, including the director of CIA, the current director of Central Intelligence. Yes. So you kind of have Xi Jinping's dream team in charge of American national security. That's what I meant by we're not earlier when I was suggesting, you know, we're not just talking about incompetence and less than ideal. Pretty soon you begin to think, I don't really like this word because it gets overused, but you begin to think this is truly existential. This is like threats that actually threaten the existence of the country.
You know, you talked earlier about how the CIA's job is not to get involved in politics. And we'll get back to the China thing in a minute. Because I have, well, I'll just ask it now. Do you think that the way out of scrutiny for Hunter Biden and his dad is to at some point in time declare Hunter Biden as a CIA asset, and that's why nobody's bothered to go after him? I mean, that sounds a little airy-fairy, but I mean, I was reading over some information and I thought, you know, I bet you that, I mean, what else, how else can he get out of this? Oh, except he was he's a CIA asset. He was an intelligence asset, and we were,
there are so many things that I know now to be true that if you'd asked me about 5 years ago, I would have said that's the plot of a bad novel. that it's hard for me to say that anything's out of the question these days. The extent to which people are escaping accountability for this is truly mind-blowing. So I mentioned before that this guy, Patrick Ho, who's a Chinese intel guy, he was operating in the United States and his job was elite capture. He was buying officials. He was buying Ugandan officials, buying, I think, officials from Chad. And he was the prime contact for Hunter. He was doing the exact same thing with Hunter. The FBI is investigating this. So they're all over Ho's comms. That means they're reading his email. They're reading his texts. They've probably wired his house for sound. They've got physical surveillance teams following him. So they see what he's doing with the Ugandans and so forth. But they also obviously see everything he's doing with Hunter because they're reading his end of the communications. Okay. Charlie McGonigal was the head of counterintelligence from New York field office, which makes him basically FBI's number one spy hunter in America. So McGonigal is running this investigation. He's closing in on Ho. They arrest Ho. McGonigal is bribed by the same Chinese intel folks that he was investigating. He took $250,000 bribe from them. Again, this is not conspiracy theory. McGonigal pled guilty to all of this. Mm-hmm. This is done. I think
I forgot about that.
Okay, so McGonigal, again, Sam didn't make this up. McGonigal pled to this. He named the guy he met with. We know who he is, that he took the money.
It's a bad dream.
And And all of a sudden, the FBI investigation that has acquired all this information on the Bidens goes dead in the water. Okay. Now, you can explain that by the fact that McGonigal got bribed, and presumably that's what he got paid to do. But the FBI knows all this now. Like everything I just said to you, they know. They know McGonigal took a bribe and he shut this down. But has anybody picked up the investigation? Did anybody then say, hey, wait a second, the Chinese paid him off to shut this down. Maybe we should go figure out what it was he was digging into. Like maybe that was Hunter and Joe Biden and that's why they bribed. Years later, nobody has any curiosity as to what did the Chinese pay him to kill? Why was it worth all that money to them? So, at this point, I guess what I'm saying is I think they feel invulnerable. They feel like everything I just said is established fact. And yet nobody seems to be paying a price for it, do they?
You talked about how the CIA is not supposed to be involved in domestic politics, and yet people would say, well, the fact of the matter is that during Watergate, they were running down the call girl operation and they let the Oval Office hang, because they didn't want to be seen as pulling ops inside the United States. So they let Nixon take the fall for them. I mean, I'm giving it shorthand, but there you are. Then there's the Kennedy assassination that everyone swears the CIA had involvement in. How do you respond to those questions? You've been in the CIA. You had been in for quite a number of years, 20 years, spent a lot of time there after your military service. You seem like a stand-up guy. You left because you thought this was a nowhere position because they'd gotten so politically out of control. So what do you think about these things?
Yeah, well, to take the last point, I left because I made a decision that I was not going to be able to change it from inside. That would be my shorthand explanation. I mean, I left having been offered promotion and onward assignment, and they asked me to pick up my retirement papers. And I would be dishonest if I said I didn't think about picking them up and staying because I'd love the job. But in the end, I made the call that, no, look, if I thought I could fix all this from inside, I would stay inside and I would fix it. It's not fixable from the inside. No pretense that the CIA has not done things previously it should not do. That doesn't equal everything that everybody claims that the CIA did is fact. So JFK. I am unaware of any information that suggests that I deem credible that says the CIA killed JFK or had any intention of killing JFK. Now, CIA, you don't join CIA and you fire up your computer and you read every message on every operation that's going on worldwide. All intelligence organizations operate in the principle of compartmentation. I see what I need to see and I know what I need to know. So, it would be highly unlikely, were there a special operation that involved killing the president of the United States, that Sam would have just been able to access that on his computer. So I'm not naive here. I'm just saying I don't know of any evidence of any kind that supports that. The other thing I would say, again, this is that I have run into an amazing number of individuals since I retired who claim to have done things at the Central Intelligence Agency that I know for sure they never did. Guys who worked in the cafeteria who now represent were assassins. By the way, a term I never heard used in the Central Intelligence Agency. All sorts of guys I ran into a guy one time who talked to me about the aliens that are trapped at Los Alamos under the mountain and wanted to know if I'd ever been a part of that project. I had to tell him no, I didn't. Unaware of the aliens in her. So, this is not to dismiss serious things. That's not where I'm going with this. I'm just saying, yeah, got a lot of people running around now claiming to know things and saying they know things. And that ain't always so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some of them are crazy. Some of them have figured out a way to make money. Some of them just enjoy the fame.
What about the Watergate aspect? The fact that they were they had a mole in the Oval Office, practically. I mean, he was just
they apparently had a spy inside the White House, or at least somebody, you know.
Yeah.
They had a source of some kind. I don't want to get lost in CIA specific technical.
Oh, he was a CIA dude. He was a, and they sheep dipped through some,
As I understand, and obviously that's not within CIA's chart. What, as I understand it, the CIA director Helms, who was definitely no choir boy, mm-hmm. was actually asked by Nixon to declare the whole Watergate thing a CIA op, and so that Nixon could say, this was a rogue CIA op and I'm clean. And Helms said, I won't do that, and refused to cover the president of the United States and let him go down. Now, you could read that a whole bunch of different ways, and mm-hmm. it probably is a mix of motivations. You could say he was a patriot and he was standing up and wouldn't abide it. You could say he was a guy taking an opportunity to stick a knife in a president he didn't like. probably the second is more likely, but any event, that's my understanding. You know, I wasn't in the meeting, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. It definitely was a conversation between the president and Director Helms about the Watergate operation.
Interesting. The WMD issue in Iraq, I mean, you were there. You are the one who prepared the battlefield. You weren't, people say, oh, come on, Victoria. No, you were the guy. So tell me about, were you looking for WMD? Was that ever a pretext for which to go into Iraq? Talk to me about what you did and what your mission was.
Right. So I was the leader of the first team that went into Iraq in advance of the invasion of Iraq. So we went in late spring 2002. I don't remember the exact date. So we were in there, 10 months before the war, something like that. We were supposed to go in February, I think, February of 2002. So what's our job? Our job, initially there's 8 of us. Eventually we're, I don't know, maybe 50 guys in my team eventually. So what's our job? Our job is to, you use the exact terminology we would use, prepare the battlefield. So that everything that the American government wants done in advance of what was then supposed to be a conventional invasion from the north. American troops were supposed to come through Turkey. Ultimately, the Turks wouldn't let them transit, so it didn't ever go down the way it was supposed to, but that was the plan. So that's like this whole boatload of requirements. Collecting on Islamic extremists that had pitched up there that were working with chemical and biological weapons. This has nothing to do with Saddam. This just has to do with the chaos in the north. Collecting on the Iraqi military, trying to convince Iraqi military officers and government officials to come over to our side. Is there a chance we can get them to topple Saddam and we don't have to invade? On that list of requirements, what we would call them, which is an endless list of things the government wants to know. Oh, and by the way, obviously work with the Kurds, figure out what do they need? Weapons, explosives, training, that whole piece of it. They're our allies, lashing up with them, making the introductions, all of this sort of connective tissue. In this long list of requirements is to collect on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction programs, chemical, biological, nuclear, radiological, whatever they have, figure out the status. What I don't think people understand, and this is because of the way the administration played it later, is that that was never presented to us as you need to go figure out whether they have this or not so we can decide whether or not we're going to invade. That's not the way this worked. It was the president has made the decision we will invade Iraq. You guys need to go into Iraq to prep the battlefield as the first step in this process. Special forces will follow you. Conventional forces will follow you. The decision has been made. We are invading Iraq. In fact, originally that invasion was supposed to happen it was supposed to happen 6 to 9 months at least earlier than it did. Done. So I was never told as team leader, go collect on this because we got to decide whether we're going to invade. We are going to invade. Yes, we want you to collect on this, but in addition to 50,000 other things.
Yeah. What'd you find on WMD?
We never found any evidence.
Oh, wow.
Never present. Well, I mean, we never told the White House anything remotely like what the White House represented to the American people. Let me start with that, because I don't want to feel like people to feel like I'm beating around the bush here. We never told them that there are these programs in existence. Now, why? What makes this a little ambiguous? Saddam had previously had a chemical weapons program. In fact, Saddam used chemical weapons very extensively against the Kurds and the Iranians. He killed horrifying numbers of Kurds, destroyed entire towns with chemical weapons. So the Iraqis were known to have had a chemical weapons program. So the question is he telling the truth when he says he's walked away from it? And this is where it really gets twisted. So Saddam walks away from his chemical program because he actually is afraid we're gonna come after him. But he also knows he lives in a tough neighborhood, and therefore, if anybody ever actually believes he's telling the truth amongst his neighbors, they might come for him. So at the same time he's telling us the truth, he's lying to his own people, telling him he still has chemical weapons. So, for instance, I debriefed a three-star Iraqi general once who was working for us. This is during the war. I said, are there chemical weapons at your base? He said, yeah. So where are they? He said, they're in these bunkers. I can look at the imagery from the satellite. The bunkers exist. I said, what kind of agents are in there? Nerve gas, yada, yada, mustard gas. When was the last time you looked at them, General? How do you know they're still in the bunker? Because I can't go in that bunker. It's under the control of the Republican Guard, which is a special unit. So the bottom line is, you believe they're still in the bunker, but you can't actually tell me they're still in the bunker. You don't actually really know that they're still in the bunker. You just think they are. In any event, what did we tell them? We never told them we found any evidence of an active chemical program. We never told Washington we found evidence of an active bio program. We sure as hell did not tell them we had any evidence of an active nuclear program. Never sent any of those things. In fact, when I heard Colin Powell on a pirated TV signal from Iraq giving his speech to the United Nations, we had a large portion of the team sitting in the team house watching that. And all of us were looking at each other thinking, we're the only guys in Iraq. Ain't nobody else here. So, and we didn't tell them any of those things. So where would they get this intelligence from? Who's talking to them that would tell them these things? Because first I ever heard of any of that. Very bizarre.
Why did they send you there? And how did you get together your team to, and from where did you pick those?
Well, they sent me there because I was stupid enough to volunteer. In fact, I actually, it's the story of my life. No, I heard they were putting together a team, and I had spent a lot of time working with the Kurds and spent a lot of time in that specific area of the world, meaning Turkey, Kurdistan, all that area. And I thought, look, this is my job, and we're getting ready to send guys in harm's way. And I know that area as well or better than anybody else. So you're not going to find a better team leader. So I'm not going to sit here at a desk while you do this. Then we just started, you know. One of the strengths of CIA is it has no structure, and so it can morph into anything it wants to morph into. One of the weaknesses of CIA is it has no structure. So when you end up in a situation like this, you end up kind of grab bagging a team. So, you know.
Was this before the paramilitary portion of the CIA was born? I know that you grew. Oh, okay. How long has that always been in the CIA? I just didn't know about it until Afghanistan.
So, I mean, what they call, what they used to call anyway, Special Activities Division, which is sort of a ground branch and air branch and maritime branch guys that has been around for in some form or another for a long time. And there were a bunch of those guys on our team. But we pulled guys from a lot of different places. I mean, mostly I just wanted guys that weren't all guys, men and women, who knew what they were doing, who are competent, but are also really level-headed and stable. You know, I mean, there's a lot of frustration and a lot of ambiguity in operations like that. You know, you're up, you hear these expressions like shades of gray and maze of mirrors. I mean, you in CIA, when you're running operations like that, you don't get like, here's a deck of cards. Here's all the variables. Everything's crystal clear. What do you want to do? It's never like that. It's always, here's some clues. Make your best call. Is this guy lying to you? Is he not lying to you? That kind of stuff. And you need very competent people. You also, and they have to be steady, I guess is the way I would put it. It can't be drama queens. They can't get too overexcited. They can't get too depressed. They gotta expect that something's going to go horribly wrong. And then they're going to have to get up the next day or 5 minutes later, they're going to have to suit up and they're going to go have to do something. That's the job, whatever it takes. So, you know, more than anything else, you just need that kind of stability, that kind of solid foundation.
So you had all these badass people whom you've collected. You're preparing the battlefield. But for what reason? I mean, clearly they were going to go in and take out Saddam. But to what extent did Saddam have to do with the Al-Qaeda guys that flew into the World Trade Center towers, the Pentagon, and Shanksville?
Yeah, nothing. Absolutely nothing.
So what was the point?
Saddam had absolutely nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, 9/11, anything like that. Yeah, well, how the White House made the decision initially that we're going to go from invading Afghanistan to our next target is we're invading Iraq. That's probably at some point a common answer. I can't give you an answer on that. All I know is that decision was made, and that decision was made by, well, I mean, I became formally team leader in February of 2002. I think that's right, circa that time frame. So by that point, I mean, I was the team leader and I'm standing up a team. And then while we're waiting to get in country, series of delays, we're training and well, you just talked about you're grabbing these people and you're pulling them together and that's great. But they're not a team. They're not a unit. They haven't worked together. So it takes some time to get them up to speed. And it also takes some time to get, not all of them have worked in the kind of environment we were going into. But it's a very good question. Why is Saddam the next target? And you know the WMD thing, I think, becomes
the raison d'être.
It becomes when the White House finally gets to the point where they're getting close to pulling the trigger on this. My analysis: they get to the point politically where they're thinking, we got to justify this to the American people. We got to answer basically the question that you just asked. And we don't have any evidence this guy was connected to 9/11 because he wasn't connected to 9/11. So why now? And yes, he's a sadist and a monster, and I don't lose any sleep over Saddam being dead. But why now? Why do we have to actually go invade Iraq? And that all of a sudden WMD becomes the hook, the pretext. You're going to say, if we don't do this, he could launch a WMD attack in the United States. I'm sorry, we don't have any intelligence at all that suggests that that is a current threat.
So I did understand that after months and years afterwards, that there was some cross-pollination between Iranians and people inside Iraq who gave the 9/11 hijackers comfort, places to stay, and transit over Iraqi territory. Is that not true?
I don't know that it's true for the 9/11 people. If that's true, I don't know that. It is definitely true that Al-Qaeda personnel have transited Iran. And it is definitely true that Al-Qaeda personnel have, I was going to say, been based out of Iran. It's unclear in some cases to what extent they're operating from there or to what extent they're almost under house arrest there. But they've been given when I say house arrest, they're not being oppressed in any way. It's just sort of like, maybe a better way to put it is safe haven.
Yeah. They, you know, they're Sunnis, right? And right. Iran's Shia.
When I went in, when we went into Iraq in the summer of 2002, and we were setting up the first 8 guys, there were a whole bunch of al-Qaeda guys and other associated extremists that were down in the border area of Iraq and Iran in the area controlled by the Kurds. So this whole northern part of northern strip of Iraq at that point was basically an autonomous Kurdish zone because we had a no-fly zone. So ever since the first Gulf War, it was almost like a separate country, actually multiple countries. And so you have lawless areas where there's sort of no government in some places. And in some of those areas, there were Islamic extremists, and there were a number of al-Qaeda personnel who had fled Afghanistan because by this point we had invaded, crossed all the way across Iran, and ended up in what technically was Iraq, but not under Saddam's control. And they were playing with chemical and biological weapons. So one of the things we did first was go there and get chapter and verse on those guys and find out how far along are you. We captured a bunch of those guys. Anyway, we dealt with that threat. But to get there, to get to Iraq from Afghanistan, to your point, all those al-Qaeda personnel had to cross Iran. They did not do that by hiding from the Iranians. That's not how that happened. The Iranians allowed them to cross, helped them cross.
And then in both Iraq as well as Afghanistan, we began a process of mission creep, the likes of which I don't think we've ever seen before in American history.
Look, I'm very happy you brought that up because, look, the horror of what happens in Iraq, I mean, this parallels in many ways Afghanistan, just like you said, is after all of the things that go wrong, Saddam is gone. The government has toppled. Pretty much we install a new government, allow the Iraqis to begin a long process of wherever they're going to go, and we're done, right? We have achieved victory despite ourselves, as we often did. And then the first thing that happens is Paul Bremer shows up.
I was just going to say, Paul Bremer shows up and says,
if you were ever in the Ba'ath Party, you can't hold a government job. So the Ba'ath Party being Saddam Hussein's party. Okay, well, if you read a book about Iraq for 5 seconds, you would know that in order to have a government job, you had to become a member of the Ba'ath Party. It didn't matter if you liked Saddam or not. So, Paul, you just fired the fire department, the cops, the guy who runs the electrical plant, the transportation. You fired the entire Iraqi government, Paul. Who's turning the lights on tomorrow? Who's going to respond to a robbery? And then he disbanded basically the entire Iraqi military and all of their security services in a country where the Shia and the Sunnis have been trying to kill each other for 1,500 years. So that's the functional equivalent of you got a pressure cooker and the heat's on and you just took the lid off, Paul. You know, if you spent like literally 2 minutes reading a book about Iraq or asked anybody any questions, they would have said, if you're going to do that, this country is going up in flames, which, of course, it did. It went up in flames. In fact, I heard that announcement on the television. I was there working and the television's playing in the background. I think I was out in the break room. And the first thing I said was, that's how bad the press is. That can't possibly be true. And then I walked back into my office and read a message and thought, oh my God, we did that thing. And by the way, all of those, the entire Iraqi military by that point had gone home and they all took their guns with them.
Yeah.
We didn't kill them all. They just went home and they took all their ammo and guns. And now you not only did all that, but all of that implies that you just cut off their paychecks too. So none of those guys have a job. None of them have an income and they all have guns and they all hate you. Grotesque.
Your belief is that through looking back at all of these disasters, that the CIA should, first of all, get better intelligence. And the only way to do that is to have human intelligence and humans, literal people.
Right.
Insinuated and embedded in like a tick in some of these places.
Yes.
Why don't they do that?
Well, first of all, folks have to understand that this is absolutely essential, right? World War II, the Germans lined up something like 2/3 of the German army on the Russian border and then staged a surprise attack on the Russians. Now, just think about that. I'm sorry, because that's a lot of guys and a lot of tanks and a lot of noise. And you know, it's not like the Russians couldn't see them, because the Russians did not, in fact, have the critical sources they needed to tell them what Hitler's intent was. And they bought off on his story that he was preparing to invade England and staging war games out of the reach of British aircraft. Now, to what extent that's self-delusion on the part of Stalin, yada, yada, we could talk about that. But the bottom line is they didn't have the intelligence to tell him, and this is critical. It happens all the friggin' time. So all the satellites in the world and the eavesdropping will not fill that most critical gap. Why don't they do it?
It's hard.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, espionage is a weird business. It's a craft. It's very arcane. You cannot teach everybody to do it. It requires a mix of a lot of skills and personality traits. And then you have to really train people very well to a high standard, and you have to season them. Like, they got to go to the field, and that's great that you, it's great that you made it through the farm, buddy. Now go make about 500 asset meetings and we'll let you talk in the morning meeting once you actually have some clue what you're doing. And then you just have, I mean, then you got to have that fine balance between, you got to have a little bit of that fighter jock mentality. Well, more than a little bit of the fighter jock mentality.
Well, swagger.
Possible. But you also have to, it has to have, what was the guy who, General Donovan, who created the OSS, called it disciplined daring.
Yeah.
Right. And it's got, you got to have that. Yeah. You're willing to really take some risks and push the envelope, but you're calculating all the time. When you're taking a risk, you're willing to take it, but you know exactly what the risk is and you know what the odds are. And you also know when it's time to say, pack it up. We're out of here right now. Like, everybody drop what they're doing and move. We got about 30 seconds to be off the X. So, yeah, it's hard. It gets easier to just build a big bureaucracy and build buildings and fill it with flat screen computer monitors and that kind of thing. And unfortunately, CIA started down the road a long time ago of promoting people not based on what they were doing in the field, but based on office politics and things like that. So over time, you have fewer and fewer folks in charge who have been there, right, and done that at 3 o'clock in the morning on the street and understand. So we have to get back there. I mean, it's kind of like if you imagine the United States Marine Corps and you looked at it and you just thought these guys have lost their edge. You know, they don't. What would your prescription be? It would be like, you guys got to get back to doing what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Got to get your edge back. That's where CIA is.
And what did we do after post 9/11? We set up a new, huge bureaucracy that now oversees all the other spy agencies.
Yes, ma'am. You're 100% right.
I mean,
the director of National Intelligence, the worst possible thing. We did not need another layer of bureaucrats on top of layers of bureaucrats. What we probably needed to do was take, not only not do that, but take about 1/3 of the people at his CIA headquarters and send them to the field. That's what we probably needed to do. Boot them out. We were talking earlier about accountability. I mean, the CIA exists basically in reaction to Pearl Harbor. The idea is we're never going to suffer a surprise attack again. So I'm pretty sure that's what 9/11 is. You failed in your fundamental mission. Now, how many guys in senior positions lost their job at CIA the day after 9/11? The answer is none. None of them. And I know so many people, including my wife, who's also a CIA officer retired, who proposed operation after operation against bin Laden over the course of several years, designed to prevent this from ever happening. And every one of them was turned down, shut down for one reason or another. No, we're going to go in and destroy his operations in Sudan. No, we're going to go kill him in Tarnak Farms in 1998. No. We're going to go kidnap him in Tarnak Farms in 1998. No. Every one of the guys who made those calls should have lost their job.
And that's after he declared war on the United States.
After he'd blown up two embassies. And then he subsequent to that almost sank the USS Cole.
That's right.
Still we didn't take the gloves off.
I recruited
a guy in Al-Qaeda in 97, I think. I was forced to terminate him, shut off. Terminate is not a euphemism for killing him. I was forced to break off contact with him a few months later because he was a citizen of a friendly Middle Eastern country, and we were more worried about offending them if we got caught than having a source inside Al-Qaeda. The day after 9/11, I kid you not, I was sitting at headquarters. Guys from Counterterrorism Center came to me and said, "Do you know where he is now?" They had pulled up the file. And I'm like, I don't know what you guys are smoking. I have no idea. First of all, I fired him. So I suspect he went back to work for the enemy and he's out there trying to kill us. But are you kidding me? It's a counterterrorism operation. He never knew my true name. You think we exchanged Christmas cards? Wait, how on earth would I keep track of this guy? If we'd been running him all this time, maybe we wouldn't have had a bunch of planes just fly into buildings.
So you had him in 1997. This is 4 years after the first World Trade Center bombing that they tried to do with a car bomb in the parking garage. And that
he was on his way to East Africa to set up their structure in East Africa. This is before two of our embassies were attacked in East Africa.
No, that's so, what I mean. But I mean, we already knew about bin Laden.
Yeah, we were in on the ground floor in advance of both of those attacks, and then we shut down the operation. But look, that's an example. I mean, what I'm saying, it's not about like Sam had the key. It's like there were people like this continuously over years saying, I don't know if you guys noticed, but this guy's serious, and maybe we need to do what we need to do before a whole bunch of people die. And they were, all those ops were shut down.
Wow.
So I feel like that's a perfectly depressing note. I've really brought it to.
It is, but it's, you know, that just shows in relief just how much we have to make sure things like this, at least we have the people in place not to allow that to happen again. Can I go back to Benghazi? I know I have to let you go pretty quick here, but Benghazi, they were dealing guns, right? They were gun running out of Benghazi. Is that what the deal was? Or why was Chris Stevens even there? Yeah. What was Chris Stevens doing there? Why was he even there, the ambassador?
Well,
it's never been fully explained to me. I mean, they were running guns, this and that. And I'm like,
I think those are two different questions. The CIA was to some extent, I think part of their operation there was to try to buy back things like Stinger missiles and stuff like that.
Try to buy back. Okay.
Yeah, because we gave the Afghan Muj one quadzillion Stinger missiles, and then they've been roaming around the planet forever, and you can take down commercial airliners with them. So CIA for years.
So they were buying back. It was like a gun buyback. It was a gun buyback program.
Buy that back. They were doing a whole bunch of other stuff, just generally collecting on the chaos and the madness and all of that stuff. Why was Chris Stevens there? Chris Stevens was there because I think he genuinely believed in this whole idea about being a diplomat and outreach, and that he needed to be out talking to the Libyan people. It wasn't some super secret mission. The sick part is that diplomatic security, who are the guys who guard the real State Department people, they've been telling Washington they've been telling their headquarters, main state, forever. We have nothing close to adequate resources here. This is the Wild West. There are Islamic terrorist groups here that are basically Islamic terrorist armies, huge militia with all sorts of heavy weaponry that operate. These guys can put hundreds, if not thousands, of people out. This is not a couple of guys. And we got the ambassador showing up, and he's got two diplomatic security guys, is his security team. And then a bunch of local guards. And I'm sorry, look, this is not meant, you know, I'm not trying to denigrate these people. It's, look, I'm the local guard. When it really hits the fan, man, and the war started, I'm going home to my family. I'm not dying for you guys that are stupid enough to show up here, right? I mean, this happens to us all over the Middle East all the time. The first shots fire an attack on a diplomatic compound, your local guard force boogies. They take off. If you think those guys are going to fight to the death for you, you're crazy. And why should they? What, you're paying me? I got a wife and kids, man. I'll find another job tomorrow, but not if I'm dead.
On 9/11, by the way. Yeah.
This is, you know.
Benghazi happened on 9/11. Oh, and then here's Susan Rice telling us it's raining and while she's peeing on my leg.
The really twisted part of this, I think, is, you know, they never, the ambassador is killed. No American relief force is ever sent to the CIA compound. The relief force that came from Tripoli, the capital city, consisted of basically CIA guys, DOD guys, every guy at the embassy with military background or training who'd ever been in the military, who kind of knew how to carry a gun, gets on a plane that the CIA acquires from an asset. We call in a favor with a guy. He produces a private plane. We load our ad hoc group of, I used to be in the Army 10 years ago kind of force. And that's who goes and relieves Benghazi. That's who shows up. Now, along with them are some other guys that were active, some active CIA guys and so forth. It's not all long in the tooth guys, but it is very much a pickup basketball team. It's just an ad hoc group of guys who all say, well, nobody else is coming. We're going to get on a plane and go save fellow Americans. And that's how they survive. And then the CIA calls a friendly Islamic militia, presumably pays them a big chunk of cash, and they send those guys in too, while the entire United States military sits and watches. And I don't say that to badmouth them. They're waiting for the commander in chief to give the order, and the order never comes. So we watch. The only reason all those guys don't die is because fellow Americans on the ground in Libya decided we're not going to let it happen.
So did you spin up these guys to go out there? Is that, you were the Middle East
guy?
I didn't spin them up.
Where was I? No, I was out by then.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I was still working with the intelligence community, but I was not working with CIA.
Okay. Okay. I was just wondering if that, because they get these guys and they're on a plane, and I can recall stories that their plane wasn't allowed to take off. So I'm just wondering if that was a different plane.
There was a plane. The Marines had a quick reaction force basically sitting in Rota, Spain.
Yeah.
And they were, the Marines, you know what the Marines did. The Marines mounted, got ready, grabbed their gear, and were ready to get in the plane and rock and roll. They're there in a heartbeat. Then Hillary Clinton, when it decided it might be too provocative for them to arrive in uniform and wanted them to change into civilian clothes. I'm not making this up.
No, I remember this.
Okay. And then they go back and forth through this stupid dance sitting next to a plane, going back and forth between changing uniforms and civilian clothes while Americans are dying.
My God.
Because her concern at this point is whether the presence of U.S. military people in uniform will be too offensive. That's what her priority was. Not that people are dying.
You know, when you put it that way, I mean, I knew it was bad. I'd forgotten about the changing of the clothes, and then they got grounded. Right? They never let them go.
They never allowed them to go. So you like. Look, I mean, it's Libya. It's the southern shore of the Mediterranean, right? You got American forces in Italy. You got American forces in Greece. You got ships at sea. You got guys in Spain. You've got the whole half the U.S. Army sitting in Germany. This is not, I mean.
You had people.
You got a lot of people and a lot of assets and a lot of guys who all you had to do was give them the order and boom, they would have been there. No, nobody on the military side said, I don't want to go. This is, yeah, I mean, we're letting them, it's unconscionable. You're letting Americans die. And then you decide to make it even worse because now you're going to lie about it after you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really twisted.
Yeah. And Ty Woods and Glenn Doherty are gone.
Look, there are a lot of really good guys. You referenced earlier the debacle in Afghanistan. My team medic, when I went into Iraq in 02, was the last CIA guy killed in Afghanistan. And he was killed literally as the withdrawal was going on within a week of that. Now, that guy, he was my team medic. We went into Iraq. He had just come out of Afghanistan, so he volunteered in 01 to be on one of the first teams into Afghanistan to go in, came back out about long enough to change clothes, was back in Iraq with me, and then probably had been downrange 15 times more before he finally gets killed, literally as we're walking out the door. And you were talking about sacrifice, right? Like, how many folks have made that kind of sacrifice? And then you got a guy like Joe who just says, I don't care. We're going to wash it all away, walk away, and continues to do that to this day. I mean, ultimately, look, we'll have to go back.
Oh, well, why we gave up Bagram is just, did you know Mike Spann, the first person to be killed at Tora Bora?
I did not know Spann. I worked later with his wife, who was also in the organization, and another one of the guys on my team in Iraq was with Spann at Mazar Sharif when he was killed. I mean, he was physically in the yard where they were basically questioning Al-Qaeda prisoners, Taliban prisoners, when the riot started and Spann was more or less literally torn to pieces by these animals. And the guy, one of the guys that was with me in Iraq, he was there physically, like right next to Spann when all this went down. But barely got out with his own life. And I think very, very, very unfairly was always kicking himself, like somehow he should have been able to prevent this. And you're like, nobody could have prevented this, man.
They literally ripped him apart.
Horrifying.
Oh my God.
And you know, that another great guy, right? A Marine officer who then joined CIA and became a case officer, and wife was an outstanding lady, and lovely family and all of that. And killed.
Man. Well, I got my Mitch Rapp shirt on, and, cause you're the closest thing I think I'll ever get to an actual Mitch Rapp. And I was going to ask you in closing, because I could go on, I could talk hours with you, and I don't want to ruin my first time with you to take too much of your time. So appreciate the time you've given me, but I do have to ask, have you ever been asked to be a special consultant for either movies, television, or literature?
So I have been asked a couple of times to consult or be involved with shows, with projects. And in the end, I walked away from those offers. And why? Because I didn't feel like they were serious. And I mean, let me be clear. My favorite spy show is Burn Notice. You ever watch that
really?
Show?
Oh, really? Yeah. My daughter, that was one of her favorite shows.
Completely, absolutely absurd. It has nothing to do with the real business of espionage. And I find it hysterical. So I'm not really somebody who's sitting around got to watch nothing but dry, depressing stuff all the time. Like, sure. I can get into whatever his name is, that the lead guy and his, you know, goofy narrations and Burn Notice and all this stuff, because it's just fun. But if you're going to represent yourself as doing something serious and yeah. purport to be serious, and we're going to expect people to take it as something serious, well, then let's be serious. And if you start trying to take this off in a direction where it's kind of junk, then I don't really want my name
yeah,
attached to
it. I get it. Yeah, I get it.
I will say this. The best show for the best movie for the psychology of espionage is Spy Games with Redford and Brad Pitt. You ever watch that movie?
I've never seen that movie, and I will now.
So toward the end in particular, when they end up in China, it gets a little goofy. But the psychology, it involves Redford being the old hand who teaches Brad Pitt as the new guy how to be a spook. And again, it's the psychology of the game, if you will. And it's a very serious game. I think that's actually a line Redford uses. But the psychology of what he teaches Pitt, of how to think, things like you never tell an unnecessary lie, that are dead on. I don't know who consulted for them, but somebody who'd been in the trade. So I would highly recommend that.
What books do you recommend? You could just give a couple of them. I'm sure you could probably recommend a lot of them, but for insight into what it was that you did.
Well, Gary Bernson is the guy who took the first team into Afghanistan. And the team was called Jawbreaker. And that's the title of the book, Jawbreaker. I would highly recommend that. Now, that's a little narrow slice because all CIA guys are not invading Afghanistan all the time.
Yeah.
But that's pretty dead on. Well, it's very dead on. I mean, it was published with the clearance of the organization. So the organization chopped off on it. It's dead on accurate. And I think one of the things you get from that is like, see, everybody's always thinking the CIA, you must have this, I don't know, you got a spy base disguised as a cloud hovering over Los Angeles, you know, like something out of the Avengers, you know. Then you get down to Gary and he's going into Afghanistan. He's the tip of the spear. It's an old Russian helicopter leaking hydraulic fluid. And there's like eight guys on board. And when they get there, they're camping on the, you know, they're sleeping on the floor in sleeping bags in a mud hut. That's the high speed, low drag operation. So.
Or going in on horses like the horse soldiers did.
They ultimately ended up using horses. Yeah, 100%. Yes.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for
thank you
talking with me, Sam Faddis. You've been fascinating, and I hope that at some point we can speak again and that you'll say
absolutely.
Yes.
Happy
so,
to.
Thank you so much for coming on the Adult in the Room podcast.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Adult in the Room podcast. To keep the programs you like to listen to, please rate this podcast with a fantastic 5 stars on your Apple Podcast app every time you listen. And give me a great review. Plus, of course, subscribe to the podcast. It makes a difference with the big tech algorithm and the big tech oligarchs, and it makes us easier to find. Please get in touch with me on all the big tech stuff. Yeah, we're still there. Using the names Victoria Taft or the Adult in the Room podcast on MeWe, Parler, Minds, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks to 1A Cast for imaging, editing, and production. The fantastic song is Gospel by the March 4th Band of Portland, Oregon. Music for Antifa versus Mike Strickland is Ride or Die by Raps by RC. The Adult in the Room podcast is also a production of Flamingo Road Studios. Remember, head up, heart out, and strive to be the adult in the room. Till next time, mischief managed.